Wiggly World 133.
Hello. A Wiggly World, a Wiggly World. When somebody does something that you don't care for, you just realize everyone has and lives in their own reality. Behind the mask, perception is not everything, it's the only thing. Well, there you have the whole guide to life. Have fun with that. A Wiggly World.
It's never straight up and down.
Hi, everybody. Free Ballin' Friday. Hey, it is Friday, and I have no topic, so it is completely free balling. I have received some letters, but I don't have them before me. I know that someone very special to the show, someone I might not be here without as far as talking to you or doing things as easily or conveniently or as professionally, perhaps. Noel has contacted me, and that's why I have to get behind a mic, because he's not on Facebook anymore. And if you know, if you're not on Facebook, you can't be friends anymore. That's how that goes. So he's given up on the Facebook. He feels much happier. He feels lighter in his trousers. I don't know. He feels quite well. He's, you know, he's lost a lot of that Facebook stress baggage, I guess. And I can understand that. I think I mostly interface with Facebook through other applications, you know, especially like Twitter. If I tweet something, then it goes to Facebook. If I do some other things, it goes to Facebook. If I do this, that, or the other, it goes to I said the same thing. So I use Facebook. That's how I sometimes keep in touch with people that I would probably not keep in touch with otherwise. I can also, you know, find out about my friends without having to be so involved. And you know why some people use Facebook, you know, way too much. I can see that, and I can see that pressure. But even things like Noel's Justin TV account, if I think he's still doing that, N-O-E-L-I-N-O, after Justin.TV. And see, right on there, you can Twitter, you could Facebook, you could even MySpace, which... I went to MySpace recently because I made a commitment that I'm going to start doing artwork at least once a week, and I'll explain why and the blackmail. No, pact, a deal, perhaps a truce. Not really, but I'll explain that. I hope. I don't know where these things go. They can go all over the place, as it has already done. But MySpace. Went to MySpace and tried to remember how to log into there. And I only want to be keeping the trapdoor MySpace going, because everyone knows that when you're looking for a band, you go to MySpace. Especially if you're another band that wants to promote yourself, and then you go on other people's MySpaces and you know, you spam your junk onto their wall thing. I don't even know what they call them anymore. I was quite surprised when I got there. It's MySpace.com/gettrapdoor, as one word, get trapdoor. And I was just shocked at what I saw. It looks like the One Ads, I think. That's what this whole gimmick looks like now. But the reason that I was trying to go back, and I do have a Bionic Wiggly one over there too, or a Wiggly or whatever the hell it's called, but because I can't leave, I'm having a hard time making it know I'm me with another email address, because I don't use the one that I set it up as, and then it times out, and then I can't leave there. So I'm still there as Wiggly somehow, but I don't know how. and I've tried this a couple times. I'm not, you know, a dope at computer type of things, but this one is just not working. So I was trying to check out my trapdoor one, and it's because I'm part of this it's a network called Reverb Nation. And what Reverb Nation is, it's sort of like a cheaper version of Taxi. I used to be a part of Taxi. And Taxi is quite expensive, several hundred dollars. I don't recall exactly a year. And but Taxi was a lot more robust as far as getting you opportunities to put your music before certain types of projects. Like sometimes they would have projects for Sports Center and things like this, and I was actually accepted for some Sports Center things, but I don't think they ever used any of my material, or I would have been notified. But they did accept my submissions, and then you submit, and most of the submissions come attached with a separate fee than that you pay. And this is sort of like that. It's sort of like what was it? Not Shout. Sonic Bids. I was part of that. Pay to play, friends. Pay to play. So many bands in the world now, I guess, especially in the United States, that now the bands must pay the venues to have an opportunity to maybe be able to play at those venues. And that's just, I left Sonic Bids. I left Taxi, although Taxi was, you know, it was doing good for me. It just wasn't doing good enough. And because my stuff is doesn't really fit genres, it's difficult to describe. And it's difficult to pass on the passion that some people feel from the material. I think it's waned a little bit, a bit. That's another thing I'm talking about. But anyway, I'm part of this this gimmick here. I wanted to submit a few things and try to flesh out this Reverb Nation account that I have. And one of the things you do is try to attach your Facebook and your MySpace accounts to there. And, you know, it's really not that great, and it's just as disorganized and clumpy. And I want to submit some free things to some free things, but of course you have to then join their $6 a month Reverb Nation to submit for free things. So it's more pay to play. And then there was a $35 a year thing to have digital distribution, which I already have digital distribution, but I don't have it to Amazon, and I've been trying. Reason I need to distribute to Amazon digitally is because you can't get it on one of these Zunes or something, or one of these more respected music type of internet radios. And you can't get it on there unless you have your stuff for sale on Amazon. So I went to Amazon to create an account, and then I have to go jump through these other hoops and then send in CDs. So I've been doing that in the process, but then I saw, oh, here, they just do it for you. So I submitted one song as an entire album, which was, of course, C-Rex Save Me From What I Become. And there's a big problem there now. Now there's a problem there. You had to pay $35 a year for that to happen. But now I have a problem. Problem is that they submit to every digital distribution outlet known to the internet, just about, except, you know, some of the free ones. Well, I'm already submitted to iTunes from the other ways that I get in iTunes, my preferred method. And so now I'm going to be submitted twice to iTunes, which, you know, okay, big deal. But here's the other problem. If I stop paying my $35 a year, then I can no longer make any money off of my digital distributions. Unless I pay $50 to have them yanked, and then it might not get yanked from everything. And what happens is, then if I just stop paying my $35, then Reverb Nation just keeps collecting on my works. So, you know, it's a bit of a conundrum, and too late, it's already pushed through, but I don't know how much more I'll be trying to sell through there. I guess it depends on, you know, if it's profitable at all. You know, the reason I write songs is not to be profitable. The reason I write songs is because I like to write songs. I like to share my music. But in order for me to share my music and write songs, I need to get some money so I can live and eat sandwiches and live a normal life. And, you know, my money from my artwork isn't coming in like it used to, of course. So I'm trying to create more artwork, not because I want to make more money, but because that's what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, I stopped producing a lot of podcasts and podcast-related things because I wanted more time to concentrate on my art. But there have been a lot of things that have come in my way of that, outside of leaving all the other projects that were taking too much time. And I've even turned down a lot of projects. I'm pretty happy, proud of myself for doing this. Not because I don't want to help other people, but simply because I was spreading myself too thin. I wasn't expressing myself through other people's ideas as rewardingly as I wanted to. And I'm not sure if you know, see, even if I don't create good work for myself and doing my own thing, even if it's not good work, which is, of course, is all subjective, but even if it's not good work, at least I know that was all me. I have to turn on the air conditioner. I'm sorry if it's a little noisy. Maybe I'll put some music in back of me, like put a big giant donut going on for however many hours this might take. I hope I'm on short today. But at least I knew it was all me, and at least I knew that I got my art out of me that I had in mind, or, you know, close enough to it. But what I didn't expect was when I slowly was able to remove myself from these other projects, it followed a lot of anxiety and depression from no longer being at 10 constantly. And there've been a lot of hurdles to try to turn around that busy time, turn around that void. I don't know. It's been hard to. It's been very hard to create since I stopped, you know, Chikar, since I stopped the others so much and so many, and other people's projects and everything that entailed. There were a lot of other things going on, and I've expressed this over, you know, the past few months of A Wiggly World. So it's nothing new, but I've been doing artwork. I've been writing songs, but it's been very dribs and drabs. So I'm trying to turn that around, and there's a couple things. One very important thing that I want to talk about today that I sort of wanted to talk about as soon as I realized it. That happened Tuesday. Oh, by the way, here I am for, of course, the holiday weekend in the United States of America, which is always a fantastic time to release any type of media, any type of program. If you want your program to succeed, just release it over a time when everyone is gone. So yeah, it's good thinking there, Wig. Good thinking. I'm always looking to further my outreach here. But that notwithstanding, Tuesday I went to the psychiatrist that I see usually on Tuesdays, usually around 11 a.m. Every so many months to check up on how I'm doing with my medications. I think I am almost there. What I am doing now is 400 milligrams, right? Yeah, mg's. 400 milligrams of Lamictal. Now I'm going to take 200 in the morning-ish and 200 in the early evening, and I think that's going to finally do it for me as far as what I need in addition to the other type of therapies that I partake in. I also am on like a beta blocker, very small dose. I think it's 20 milligrams, 20 to 40 if needed. Over the course of a day, 20 perhaps before I embark on something that I might have social anxieties. And then I also have like a half a Xanax, very small dosage to help with my driving angst, that anxiety that happens. It's been very difficult to drive lately. However, that has begun to change. It's hard to know where to start with this story because it's of course there's no events in it. It's just been a very long process that happened in a very short amount of time. So where should I start? Let me start with driving. I'll start with driving. I think that can help lead into things. I used to have the Hot Whip. It was a car that I bought off of Stan, a good friend of mine, Stan, who also did podcasts with me, like Magic Milkshake Machine and Smart Wrestling Fan, and all around good guy. He now lives on the West Coast, and he sold me his little Whip. Not banging around. It's too European. A beater. He sold me his beater. We also refer to that as a hoopty around these parts. And I call it the Hot Whip. Chiz called it the Hot Whip. And it was a little white Toyota Corolla, 5-speed, which was, I loved that car. Fantastic car. Of course, you know, it had about a billion miles on it, and it was up for inspection this month, and I knew, number one, I've been having a hard time finding tires for it, so I knew that the tires weren't going to pass inspection, the front ones especially, and that would have meant I would have had to get all new wheels and the tires and the things and the hubs and the you-know-what goes on there better than I do, because I don't know anything about cars. And it would have needed that. Every year, maybe twice a year, the exhaust system falls off the engine, so it needs to get welded back on, so I would have had to do that. And to make a long story short, it would have taken several thousand dollars to fix. And I must have put the windows back on the tracks about well over a dozen times, and each time you take apart the door and put the door back together, a couple of the screws fall off, a couple of the snappy things break, a couple of this happens, a couple of that happens, you strip this, that doesn't go on right, now it doesn't roll up all the way. I need two new doors, basically, to make both sides of the windows go up. And, you know, the heater didn't work anymore, and I've replaced the fuses before, but this time the fuse replacement didn't work, and now I still have the motor for the exhaust system, the fan system, but I didn't really think that was going to work anyway, and so now I have an extra gimmick there I could try to, I don't know what, make some type of crazy. I used to make crazy things for our Epicurean band shows. One was this like foam head that I made to look like some sort of swamp alien with Alice Cooper makeup and a bush gone, and it would just spin around in a circle very slowly, turn its head 360 like that. So I can make something like that. So the car was, I knew I needed to get a new car. That was going to be the better choice. My limit for cars is usually $500. But I did see this one Scion that I enjoyed. And it was at this local, not a gas station, it's a little corner lot with maybe like 15 cars in the lot. And, you know, they take it in, it's a garage, so they could also, you know, like fix your car. And they fix up these used cars, I guess, and then they sell them. So I stopped there the other day. I didn't talk to any representative because there was nobody there. There were people like going between the office and the garage, just walking back and forth trying to find someone to talk to about, I don't know what, their car, a car in the lot, I don't know. So I saw a Scion, and I walked up and I looked at the label. It said around $6,000. And financing available, cracked windshield, but they will put a new windshield on. They don't say if they're going to charge it for that or whatever. They have another windshield there for it, they say. So I called the next day, and of course, no one answers the phone for about three different times I called during the day. Then someone answered. I said, I'm interested to know what the financing looks like on that car. And they said, well, you have to bring your own finances. We don't finance. Oh, okay. So I had said financing available on the label. So I said, that's odd. I thought it said financing available on the label. Okay, thank you, bye. So I called, I looked online for, you know, Toyota dealers for Scions. Because I figured, oh, well, I guess a used one would be around $6,000. And I could probably afford financing on that. If I can afford maybe, you know, keep my financing under $100 a month, then I'd be okay. Or around $100. And then hope that I don't lose my jobs that I have. So I went online, and they have this credit checker. Find out your credit score, estimate it without, you know, putting any marks against the credit reporting agencies. It's sort of like this, you know, a thing that guesses by how many loans you out, how much you owe on them. Have you ever missed a payment? How old are you? That type of thing. That's all these questions. And of course, at the end, when you get done doing this lengthy questionnaire, the only way that you're going to find out what you qualify for is if, of course, if you put your phone number and email address or something like that in there. Well, I did that because it's a local dealership and I was going to have to go to one of these anyway. And I found out, you know, I qualify pretty well, pretty high up there, and you know, mid to high 700s. And of course, like 3 minutes later, I get a call from the dealership. Well, you know, what are you doing? They tell me that their used car started at $6,000, and I was asking about the Scions. Well, when I got there, there were no Scions that were $6,000. They were all like 12 to $13,000, $14,000, $15,000, because they only had like last year's model. They didn't have any older Scions in there. So I looked around a lot. I found this these other ones that looked like the Hot Whip and things like this, and I really liked them. The problem was, and I looked at a lot of other cars as well. I've already gone too long with this story. Because I qualified for, you know, quite good cars, but I simply would not accept any payments that were going to be too high. And those Scions would have been like $240 a month or something like that. I just could not afford that. So now the problem with these smaller cars was that the one was like $4,500. They wouldn't finance it, number one, because it was too, it wasn't expensive enough to finance. The bank didn't want a part of that, their bank that they use. And two, you have to also watch on mileage and age of the vehicles, because if they're too old then, or have too many miles on it, then the banks think that, you know, it won't make it too much further. So it won't make it the six-year loan or whatever type of loan you get, 4 to 6 year. And make a long story short, I got another Toyota, and it was something I definitely was not looking for. We looked at so many cars, and I was very good with just a hatchback car. The white version of this black one that I wanted was more expensive. It would have been good, but we would have had to drive into their Bethlehem lot. I was in their Easton showcase area. We're just getting ready to drive over to their Easton Bethlehem lot to look at this white one, which would have qualified for financing because it was a little more expensive. It had less mileage, and it was in working condition. The black one, like the door didn't open, kick it. He said, "Well, we have one more, Forerunner. Is that it? Yeah. It's Toyota Forerunner. It's like this giant, I looked at it, it's like this giant truck, and it was like $8,000. And it was this giant truck. I'm like, what? You mean I can afford that? That can fit into the budget that I want in? It wasn't the $100 I was hoping for a month, but it was under $200. And that was my, $200 was my drop dead price point. In fact, I'm hoping in some miraculous way that I can afford this. That's what I got. I got this 1999 Toyota 4Runner. It's jade. It has air conditioning, which the hot whip had air conditioning there for a while. The air conditioner never worked, but the heater did. This has air conditioning. This has a sunroof that tilts forward. It opens all the way backwards. It has a thing that you could cover up the sunroof when it's closed so that you don't get, you know, light distraction. It has a passive alarm system that'll, you know, go off if someone tries to open the door with the key, if you locked it with the beep beep. It has cassette. That's really the hot whip actually had a CD. This has cassette. It has four-wheel drive if on demand, if you need that. It's automatic. That was the only thing that, the only drawback to it that I thought. And plenty of room for my equipment. That was, you know, that's the main thing that I was looking for in any car. Room for me to move, haul my band equipment or DJ equipment and things like this. But it has these, you know, big tires and it's just a beautiful car. The seats fold down. There's a lot more to it that I don't even recall, but it's really something. It's really great. So I got that, and when I was driving before I went to the psychiatrist, and driving this, you know, really for the first few times, I had on my hooked up one of my Walkman, my iPod to this cassette, you know, the cassette gimmick that you get with the wire sticking out. So I put that on and I put some of my music on, and I realized that when I was driving this, first of all, comfort has a lot to do with how fast you go. Oh, this has two airbags, too. See, that was another thing. Chiz wants to start a family, so I needed a safer car, and I needed something that had airbags as well and was going to be safe in case, you know, we would have a child, which I don't know how the hell I'm going to afford that. But you know, these are things we'll work out as a family. That's another reason why I'm trying to get really heavily involved with the art community, even locally around here, because I think some of my stuff is pretty darn good comparatively, and I'd like to try to, you know, actually go for it. I always hoped that my work would speak for itself and I'd be able to just concentrate on my work, not on promoting, not on, you know, thinking I'm anything great, just on doing my what I love to do. But that hasn't worked out very well for me. So as I was driving, so comfort has to do with that. Now, when you're in a lot of comfort, you sometimes feel like you're almost going backwards when you're on a highway, a thoroughfare, where the speed limit is 55 or 65. And if your car runs well, it's not vibrating all up and down, you're not you're feeling very smooth, distances can look like it's taking you forever to get from A to B. So I understand why people go fast, but I do not. That's one of the wonderful things about cruise control, is you can actually go the speed limit and then set the cruise, and then you don't have to worry about anything else. Except staying on that highway, paying attention to what's around you, and enjoying the ride and the safety to get there. And that's what I was doing. But I noticed that with my music playing, and not playing, you know, blasting too loud so that it would distract me from other things, but it really helped me with both switching between tunnel vision of making sure I was on a road, and also a more floodlight vision about being aware of what was around me. But I also noticed that I wasn't getting as upset with people that were breaking the speed limit, because I was enjoying being surrounded by my music. Now, it would have felt different in the hot whip. It would have felt a lot different. I wouldn't have been in my own space as much. So I think that, you know, what you drive really can aid or take away from your driving experience. Now, people with road rage sometimes are in the nicest cars, you know, they're cars that you couldn't afford if you saved up for 2 or 3 years on your salary. So, you know, it's not all that, but I think it's a little bit, and especially in my case, it made a big difference to be able to be enclosed like that and in a safe spot and surrounded by things I enjoy, meaning my music. So it really helped. I didn't feel any driving pressure. You know, people still try to cut you off and whatever, but those I was able to help with the things that I've said in the past, you know, like saying, instead of flipping someone off and cursing at them, you say, they just couldn't wait. And I mean, there were a lot of really bad accidents recently where people just couldn't wait, and they made it worse for us trying to get through traffic, and people lost their lives and everything else. So that was one of the first realizations that I came to. And then I went to my psychiatrist on Tuesday, as I previously mentioned, and drove there once again. A little bit of music, iPod. I always take my iPod there because you never know how long you're going to be waiting in the waiting room there. And then I read a little bit of my books on there on the Kindle app for that thing. And so it was a pretty good ride. And normally you don't talk too much, you know, to your psychiatrist. You just tell them how you've been doing. You try to, you know, find out if you need to, you know, how your meds are working out for you, and if they need to try something else. And you, like I mentioned on the last episode in depth, that you need to be honest with your psychiatrist. And, you know, that's, I don't know if I really talked about that too much, but I think I did. I think I alluded to it when I was a kid, after my father killed himself when I was 12. My mom took me to see a psychiatrist, and I was just like, I didn't want anything to do with him. Mom, I'm doing fine, thank you. You know, so you do have to be on. You have to be to an age. You have to be to a understanding that a psychiatrist isn't your enemy, which, you know, I was probably rebelling against psychiatry back then, against any authority. So, you know, you have to be honest, and that's the only way that you're really going to get help or where you want to be mentally. And once again, it's all little bits. There needs to be, if you have, you know, irrational types of behavior that go beyond what you can address with therapy or some type of book reading, public speaking classes, you know, anything like this, and you have to take it to psychiatric intervention, medicated intervention. You still need all the little, though it's only a little bit. You're not going to take a pill and everything's going to be okay. You need to do a lot of things not necessarily a lot of things, but you need to do, you need to hit it from many angles. And this is how pretty much anything in life that you care about, anything that you want to get better at, anything that you, anything really, you need to come at it with many bits of information that either you've read about or you've gotten from teachers or other people or television or what have you. You bring these back knowledges to your project, experience, what have you. Well, the same goes for wanting to be find that balance, you know, find a healthy, happy balance. You need to come at it with different bits of information, and some bits you might not know. So you need to, you know, fill in, spread out those bits, and then all together as a whole, it can be very beneficial. So when I was for some reason, I often tear in the outside of my eyes and when I speak to my psychiatrist. Usually about, you know, I just like when I do a Wiggly World, I talk about things that just come out of nowhere, same when I talk to my psychiatrist. So oftentimes when I'm relating stories, I'll just tear out the corner of my eye for some reason. Both of them. Not really pertinent to the story, but evidently it's touching something. Something's, you know, there's a connection there, so that's good. You know, that's a good fit. If you don't have a doctor that you like or you want a second opinion, then you try to get a second opinion. Try to get another doctor. But I mentioned to him everything I summarized. Boy, did I make a lot of grammatical errors last episode. And a lot of other types of errors, so pardon me for that. I know I made a lot of mistakes. I wanted to correct those, and I think I did in the show notes. So if you read the show notes, that pretty much is what I meant to say on the last episode. A lot of mistakes. Oh, and by the way, if you'd think I didn't realize it, I know that Jeanette and other types of bath crystals and bath salts that you would put in your bath actually have nothing to do with what they call bath salts that are this artificial cocaine. So don't worry. Number one, don't put the bath salts that you get at a gas station into your water and take a bath in it. And number two, don't try to eat your Jeanette because then you'll probably die. So those two things are completely different, and I'm glad that I found out about that way too late. But that's what conversational podcasts are all about. You know, I don't know everything, of course. And I try to be as researched as I can when I talk about things I don't know a lot about. But I just didn't care about that, see. But that does not justify it. I was wrong, and I'm glad I was wrong. So I told my psychiatrist that I did this last podcast and I had a breakup with, if you didn't know, Jen Elfman and I were kind of hot and heavy in the sack of late, and then I had to break it off with her when, you know, she told me that that my e-meter was all out of whack. Now, as you know, I tweeted with Jen Elfman, and it started this snowball about child psychiatry, and at the very base of it, it turned out to all be driven by Scientology, a Scientology-based, scientific-sounding coalition of doctor-sounding people, against psychiatry, of course. And now shifted their attention to exploiting our children to get their anti-psychiatry message across. Much like, but of course quite different then, because there's not a lot of adult onsets of autism. I'm sure it's probably not unheard of, but as far as, well, probably identifying it can happen when you're in your adulthood, but... back when I spoke out against Jenny McCarthy and her, horribly researched arguments from authority, meaning celebrity, arguments from celebrity, endorsements of stopping vaccinations. And there's a great thing on Netflix you can watch about this anti-vaccination. It, unfortunately, it is before the doctor in the UK that started this whole hubbub, really, was at the root of this, had, you know, been found out that not only was he a fraud, but he actually was the lawyer that had, he was getting information from that. He was treating people that this lawyer was already suing the vaccination companies for, and he also had stock either personally or through this lawyer in this vaccination that was supposed to be more healthy or didn't work. And he was a bad person. He was a very bad person. So anyway, you know, I spoke out against, I related the story about speaking out, everything that I told you last episode. And that just, like, you know, I started tearing a little bit again. And, you know, as we talked, but I felt really good. You know, he listened to me. He was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was like, we talked a little bit about my involvement with the Skeptic Society for about the past 20 years, I think. And, you know, things like this. And it was a nice little talk that we had. So I felt good about that. And, you know, the same type of feedback I get from your letters every now and again telling me why I shouldn't stop doing this show, even though I feel like I should constantly. But it's all those little bits that keep me going. It's not just, you know, if I really felt like I needed to stop doing this program, I would. But there's a lot of, there's a lot of reasons why I still do it. Is it a labor? Is there effort put into it? Of course. Of course it takes my time. But I don't see it as much. I don't see that time as much. Because it's basically me just, you know, shooting a crap with someone that can't talk back to me, which is, I guess, how I like it. No, you know, I'd love to have feedback. And I hope we get some new listeners. And I hope that I get some letters that I can just freaking rip you a new butthole for disagreeing with me, because of course I'm 100% right on everything I say, whether I'm right or wrong. Now, driving home from the psychiatrist, I realized something, and it's something that I've known for a long time, and it's something, you know, like the best things in life, the easiest ways to make something happen often just escapes out of your mind, gets cluttered up with the hubbub, and you can't recall it when you need it the most. Like falling asleep. Many moons ago, I mentioned how you can sleep when you can't sleep, and that is by very simply, you you start at 100. It's like counting sheep, except different. Start at 100. You breathe in, and when you breathe in deeply and slowly, you try to slow down your breathing. When you breathe in deeply and slowly, you feel the air move across. Now, one thing is you need to be able to breathe. So if you have a cold, you got to try to unblock those air passages. It might be able to work with breathing through your mouth. I don't know, but it helps if you can breathe freely. So, pardon me. You breathe in. And as you're breathing in, you feel the air move across your nostrils. And you concentrate on all that in, and you can even say in. And when you breathe out, you can breathe out either through your nose or through your mouth, whatever you want to do. But you say 100. And then you do it again, very slow as you can, and you know, if you're really hyper, it's going to take you a while to slow down your breathing. And then when you breathe out, you say 99. So you count down from 100 down to 0. And if any time, and as you're breathing out, you're saying 100 in your mind. And you say the number as long as it takes you to breathe out. Now what this does, it allows you to try to You must concentrate on numbers and breathing. So this helps block out any of those spurious thoughts that are might be rushing through your head. And it also calms you. It's also soothing. So that helps relax you and helps slow down your breathing so you can fall to beddy by. And if any time along the way you forget what number you're at, counting backwards, then you have to start back at 100. And you should be asleep before you get down to zero. If not, start over. But I never make it to zero, even no matter how awake I am. So, but that's something I forget. I'll be up all night, you know, thinking, chatter, and forget that I either made that up or innovated it or did something with it. And, you know, it's something that I should know. Well, so too, something even more important, I think, was that on way driving home, I realized that in the past, I had a lot of sex. A lot of sex with a lot of different people. And that's why I have to do that sex episode. But one thing that I realized somewhere along the line, and probably with my wife now, my lovely Chiz, is that I never realized that I was confusing intimacy, the feeling of being loved and loved, only being expressed through intercourse or some part going in another part. Something going in a hole and another hole and hole and one thing going in a hole. So I only really related that sensation of love, that sensation of intimacy, that sensation of oneness of being, of love, even just love. You know, that's the only way. I bought people gifts and I wrote them poetry and I wrote, you know, things. But to me, sex was the full expression of that love. And I don't feel that way anymore. there's so much more, and it's more on a hole. Not a hole that you stick something in, but a W-H-O-L-E. It's more on a hole that this love can be expressed, that this love can be almost defined. You know, it's so much more. It's so much more. Well, I knew that I didn't need anything to make me happy. In fact, if you want to have everything that you've ever wanted, just want everything that you have, and there you go. So I knew these things, I knew these tricks, I knew these Zenism type of observations of the world. What I didn't realize was that in the past few years, definitely a few years, or maybe even more, I had somehow begun to associate things with happiness. And I don't necessarily mean physical things. I mean certain things going right, what I perceive to be as right in my life, certain things, of course, monetary things. I've been very depressed about money lately. That's been a big, huge problem because of the lack of it and the worry of not being able to pay for a house now for my car, and everything else out there. We'll look at a few years ago, very shortly. But something very, very important dawned on me, and that is, wait a minute. I always talk about not needing anything to be happy, but yet, it really are things that I am becoming either happy or not happy because of, as a result of. And I fully realized that, wait a minute, I can be happy, pardon the cliche, no matter what. I could just be happy if I want to. I could allow myself to be. It's okay for me to be happy. And nothing around me had to make me happy. I can just be happy. And, you know, you deserve to be happy. Even if you don't deserve it, you can still be happy. You know, that's something I didn't realize. I was like, oh my God, I can be happy. I'm now happy. I'm now happy, and nothing had to be going right. Nothing. I didn't have to purchase something. I can actually be happy, and my eyes can be bright, and I can smile, and I can laugh. Not like a maniac, but I can be cheerful. And of course, I realized this while I was driving isolated in my own car. Very isolated. And see, this is the appeal of self-help movements, reading a book about self-help. Boy, there you are. You're in your bubble reading your book. And it tells you you can be happy. Or you're at a convention and they're saying, see it, want it, do it, be it. You control your destiny. You will get a front row parking spot. You watch. You will see these miracles around you every day. And you're in this room, you know, hearing this motivational speaker, and you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. I am. I do deserve this. I do all these things. And you're not alone, but you're with a whole bunch of like-minded people. And guess what? Now you have that pack mentality, and you are acting as one. You're like, you know, yes, we can. Yes, we are. We are each other, and we can do it, and we deserve it, and we can manifest our own destiny. And then the problem is with this, of course, is that unless you're psychotic and just believe every thought that's in your own mind and stay cocooned in your isolated world of dementia, you're going to run into other people. And guess what? All of a sudden, it's not so easy to remember that, because now there's a whole lot of hubbub, and now, you know, everything's not going your way because people have different ideas and different they're living in their own separate worlds that they think that you're a part of as well. So now it starts tearing away at you, and now you eventually, if not immediately, realize that, guess what? Everything is perfect if I lived in a vacuum. But when other people are involved, then it's a little more complicated. But realizing that I could be happy and sharing that with the person that is so much a part of my life, you know, Chiz, then that helped. That helped. And I actually can remember better. Because why? Because I'm not saying that I'm going to find a front row parking spot. I don't even like front row parking spots. I always try to park as far back as I can so that I don't have to run someone over if I'm backing up. You know, I don't have to pay attention to people that might be driving 95 through the parking lot. I can just probably pull forward because there's no one else around me. I like walking to the store. So I don't need a front row parking spot. And most importantly, I don't need everything to go my way to be happy. Happiness can enjoy, can come from the things. Let them, if they so move you. But realize that those external things are things. Not too long ago, I talked about the negative, speaking negatively about yourself. And if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. And the same goes, of course, for your self-talk, the chatter in your head about yourself. You know, it can't be helping, but you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry. You know, sometimes self-deprecation is... Initially, self-deprecation is most likely to protect yourself. If you don't think that something that you've done is good enough, you'll crap on it yourself. And if somebody says, no, it's good, then you get that rub out of it. So it's a little bit of a protection in case someone thinks it does stink. You've already said that it stunk. But then, just like any other jokes, if you repeat these and repeat these, sometimes they become truth. I remember something silly like, you know, saying shut up to someone when they sneezed. Which is, of course, outrageous, is a stupid thing to say, and that's what it was. It was that shock humor that I like, it's not really cynical, but it's some type of shock humor. But then I remember, like, later, becoming annoyed at the sneezes. And that's just completely irrational, completely dumb. So you have to watch. You have to watch what you do jokingly, because it can actually become an annoyance to you, and it can become a reality. So you have to be careful with things like this. Just, you know, keep it in mind. It's perfectly all right to say something silly like your mastication is driving me crazy, but it actually can be that. As I've heard these sayings, people saying, like, you know, first you say it, then you do it. You know, I don't think that's almost like being psychotic and believing your thoughts to be true. They're just thoughts. They can't do anything to you. They're thoughts. Unless you act on them, then, you know, they mean nothing. You have thousands of thoughts. I don't know, per minute, per hour, per day. Well, yeah, probably have millions per day. I'm not sure, but several hundred thousands per day, I'm sure. So you have lots of thoughts, and they really don't mean anything, you know. They're just thoughts. That's all they are. Don't turn a 2-watt light bulb into a laser beam, you know what I mean? So here was something so obvious, so much, so known to me, that you can be happy. Just allowing yourself to be happy for no reason, and you know, just completely forgot about it. Completely allowed the hubbub to overshadow it. Now, it's not shirking responsibility, if that's even a word. It's not ducking responsibility. It's not excusing your responsibility from things. It has nothing to do with that. It's not a part of separating yourself from the situation. It's not a part detachment or third party type of anything. It's just simply that when I'm not anything, I can be happy, and it's okay for me to do that. Sometimes it can be not anything, but being not anything and being sad and depressed, that not to blame the victim. Like I said, if you're sad and depressed, and it's beyond the norm, you know, talk to some people, see if it is abnormal. Because, you know, our human psyche is up and down, like a roller coaster. It's a sine wave. But I'm saying it's okay, even if you're not feeling so good about yourself, it's okay to allow yourself to be happy. And that's all. And I realized that, and I was like, wow, I'm beating this to death, but you don't need things to be happy. Things don't have to go your way. You don't have to buy things. Shopping feels good, though. Shopping feels good. The act of opening gifts might feel good to you. You know, different avenues of that are fine, and they all feel good. I'm not saying don't stop doing that, but I am saying that that might not be the cause of your happiness. That happiness might already exist there. It's just that you associate these other things that have to line up before you can take that reward of feeling good. So I think that's the important message for today. That's what I really wanted to talk about. A couple other things. I started, if I haven't mentioned this before, I've been really involved with the vpforums.org, the visual pinball. I've been building my own digital pinball. It's coming along quite well. I have every piece in place that I need to do this, a digital plunger, several buttons to do the flippers with, a motion sensor to be able to enact tilt, left and right shift and up and down movements. I have a computer that's, being used for it. I have two monitors, a 3x4 or 5x4, depending on what you want to, something that could do 1280 by 1024 or 1024 by 768. That's my back glass. And I'm only using a two monitor setup. There are people that use a three monitor, a smaller monitor for the DMD, the digital dot matrix display on some systems. And then they use another one for their back glass, and then one for their, use a 16 by 9 monitor for your play field. And I was using a 16 by 9. It was, one of these iInk types of monitors that was just way too big for me to use as a regular monitor. So that's how that came into the picture. But then the other day, I was trying to do some of this extracurricular, some of these other side projects that I worked to try to generate money. I filmed Chizzy's dance recital again this year. Last year, I did it with two cameras. I only have one camera now. I gave Chikar one of my nice cameras, my high def cameras, so that they could continue to create a good looking project, product rather. After I had left the Go-Go's. So now I only have one. And I told her that, and last year I made such a nice presentation because I had two cameras. I was doing close-ups with the one. I was doing more still shots with the other. And I edited it together beautifully. It looked fantastic. I, of course, ran sound on the H4 that I used to record sound. Thanks to Kahura there for many a thing. He bought the camera. I gave away the camera I bought. How are you going to separate those monies? They were both the same price, but that's how I'll say it. Or I gave Chikara Kahura's camera because that's what it was to be purchased for, really, was to make the Go-Go a better product. So last year's 2010's recital was gorgeous. The teacher that wanted me to, never watched it, never got paid for it because I said pay whatever you think it's worth, which if she would have watched it, she would have thought it was worth $200 or more, because it was an amazing package. This year I said it's going to be a still camera shot, getting the whole stage, and that's it. Well, I ended up, of course, recording separate audio, and I synced them up, and I made nice looking DVDs, even though she doesn't have a DVD player. See, that's a problem. And I said, it'd be $50, and I'm just doing one camera and no other bells and whistles. So I did other bells and whistles, but it's still one camera and still just a one far shot. So I needed to watch this as I tried to export it from the Mac, print to tape to my VCR, which I later found out I can't do, because when I print the tape from the new Macs, they can't print the tape to 640 by whatever, 480. They have to print the tape to the 720 by blobby blue, whatever that aspect, the 3:4 aspect is at 720. So that took a long time to realize. Anyway, tech talk, nobody cares about tech talk. So I was like, you know what? I want to see, and my pinball machine is right where my VCR is. It's like taking, it's there's a table, when you put this leaf in your table to make it a bigger table. There's one of these table leafs stacked up on books, stacked up on top of a JVC Kaboom box, stacked on top of a TV tray, spread out across, and that's like in this cardboard box that is holding my monitor and my back glass and all that. It's all rigged, and that's sort of where my VCR is, under that main end table that a lot of the gimmicks are stacked up on to make this makeshift pinball machine before I start on the wood, which I just recently purchased. Just picked it up yesterday, and I'm just going to start laying out the wood, man. Now it's going to happen. And I was like, you know what? So I have to bring a TV in here anyway. I'm going to go down. I'm going to go. I'm going to grab my JVC 32-inch that I have downstairs in our living room, and I'm going to bring that up here. It's a 720p screen that you might remember my mom bought me back when I was still doing the SWF, and a gift from my mom. So I brought it up here, and I got that iInk 23-inch, whatever, something like that. And I put 22-inch, something like that. I put my JVC HD TV down as a playfield, and boy, I loved it. It looked great. So I made that bargain. I made a bargain in my mind. First of all, I looked up 32-inch televisions. Now, I'd always had hope to put like a 50-inch, 48-inch, 50-inch, 52, if they even make those, at the most, no 60-inch, no nothing like that in our living room, because I'm having a hard time seeing the 32-inch because of my eyesight, and like I said, this was a 720p gimmick. So I was hoping that one day, have like a 50-inch Samsung with the apps and stuff like that. So I looked on, but I knew that was there. Those are still like a grand. So I looked on Amazon, and I'm an Amazon associate, but I can't buy my own junk. But I did look on there, and I found this one television that was $300, and it was 32-inch, and it was 1080p. And with the extra monies that I have on my Amazon from selling things and my friends and my work buying things through Amazon, it would have taken it down to under $250. For a 32-inch television that's 1080p, and I was like, oh my gosh, maybe I can keep this as my pinball playfield, and this will be my last credit charge before I now will enjoy paying down all of my credit charges. And you might think, that I know how that goes, but seriously, I'm at my end as to what I can reasonably pay off in a month. If you can't pay 10% on your credit cards each month, then you're beyond your limit. If you're there already, then it's too late. But here's a good rule of thumb for those just getting started on credit: make sure that whatever amount you have on your credit, well, you want to stay, I don't know what it is, 80% of your limit. Because if you're above that, then it reflects poorly on your credit score. I think that's what it is. but you should only be charging no more than, if you can, you need to be able to pay 10%. You should be paying 10% per month at least, because your interest is what? So if you're just getting started, it might be like 19%. So you need to be able to do better than that. You need to be, if you can pay 20% of your credit card per month, that's great. 10%, that's great. So don't go above 10%. If you can't, if your monthly thing is you're going to only pay the minimum, you're not even putting a dent in anything. So try to keep under being able to pay 10% per month on any one of your credit cards. And all. So I thought, okay, this is going to be it for this. And just after I got done saying that, I don't need things to be happy. But here's the thing. I don't want to do my pinball table half-assed. Now, I'm not getting the 40-inch screens and the 30-inch, HD back glasses and all that business. It's still a smaller machine, but it's really not going to be half-assed. I don't think I would have truly enjoyed that mini pin that way. It's still going to be a mini pin, but at least now I can really differentiate between the back glass and the main play field and stuff like this. And if I'm going to build this thing out of wood, it'll be a good breaking in, but I don't want it to be, eventually I'd like to get the 40s if I happen to win a zillion dollars or something like that, or later on down in my life when I'm able to do this perhaps, or something that makes it affordable. And I don't want to have to rebuild something that I built quite nicely. I'll build something in addition to it, but this is going to have to hold me over for quite a long time. So that's what I did. I made a deal with myself, and I would run it by Chiz. And in order to do this, though, I had to pay myself as well as paying off all my bills. And the way that I have to pay myself is that I owe myself artwork. Artwork or music, I have to create at least one piece per week. And in good faith, before Chizzy got home, I did my first crayon piece that I've done since living at the chicken coop a few Xmases ago when I gave Chizzy her moon, and I also made that Santa, evil Santa. The Chizzy Moon in crayon. So I started doing that. Started breaking those out again. I couldn't find big paper, so I did it on just a piece of printer paper, 8.5 by 11. And the crayons I used were the first time I ever used these organic crayon rocks. Not quite the same consistency as the wax crayon. So, you know, it was okay, but I definitely had that abstract mind going. And getting back into that flow. So that was in good faith. And when she came home, I explained the whole thing. And as she saw the machine, it looked great. Okay. So that's the way we did it. And she knows I've been working on this for, well, since we lived at the coop. So that's well over a year, probably a year and a half. There's some old pictures of me. having that JVC television sideways, standing up on my TV stand, like precariously almost hanging off the ledge, like it just fall over. And then I had another monitor just like also dangling off the right hand side, acting as my back glass. So that's how it went. I found this Vizio, which used to be a pretty horrible name in HDTVs. I found this Vizio, which of course doesn't have as good sound. JVC has nice loud sound. They have nice loud sound basses, and same goes for their television. Although no HDTV really gives you the great sound. Maybe some of the Sonys do, or some of the higher end ones, which of course are way out of my price range. But the Vizio did not have as good sound out of there, but I have a stereo, so that's no problem for when I want to watch something. But it had the web apps, and I was like, if money was no object, Samsung with web apps, that's what I want. I want the web apps. And this Vizio did have them. It has Netflix, it has Hulu, which I don't run that. It has Blockbuster, which I don't run that. But it has also the thing I think I talked about last episode, which was Amazon Prime members now have access to hundreds or thousands of movies and television shows. So I could do that. And I streamed my first one a little bit before I went to bed last night after I set up my remote to try to work with this thing. A little bit. I just watched the start of Iron Giant. It looked great. It looked really good. And you could do the weather, Yahoo weather, right in the sidebar. And that I knew Chiz was going to eat up, because you can watch TV and then have the weather going on in this little side widget. So it's really nice. It interfaces with Twitter and interfaces with Facebook and Vimeo and just a whole slew of other things. So, like I said, because of my discounts, $300, 32-inch. Now, you could get things smaller than 32 inch for like $100 now, and you can get 42 inches for like I don't know how much it is, or 40 inch, I don't know, but they're relatively so in it. Well, for the same amount of money that I paid for this that many years ago for a 720p, you could be getting 1080, and it's 1080p as well. So I ended up getting that, like I said, I had that extra money, so for under $300, that's just great. So now I'm going to have a cool pinball table, and I've been looking at my JVC and picked up the wood for it. Got some I can't remember what they call MDF. Is that what they call it in the UK? It's a particle board, but it's very, very solidly constructed particle board, and very thick, and it's going to make a great case, you know, for these things. And I was talking to Chiz. I said, you know, I think I'm just going to keep the JVC all in its case, because normally they, I don't know if they call uncrating taking the screen out of your HDTV, or if that's just uncrating it from, you know, when it gets shipped to you. But I think they also call taking your HD television out of its frame uncrating in this community I'm a part of. This cult, the cult of pinball emulation. And let me tell you, pinball emulation is, number one, awesome, because you get to try to touch machines that there's no way that you'd ever be able to touch. But number two, when you go to an amusement park and you see, or you go to someplace or someone's house that actually has a pinball machine, you realize that the visual pinball is nothing anywhere close to that experience. But it is a different type. It's not a sister. It's a cousin of that type of experience, and it's much different than a video game. And it does give you that tactile feedback, and it does give you a lot of the same skill, motor reflexes, that you understand that. Of course, it has all the same rules and everything as regular pinball. So it's a side experience. It's not the same, but it is an experience that you may be able to afford, unlike trying to get, you know, working machines. Anyway, at 1 a.m. or 12:30 a.m. this morning, I decided this JVC case is, it has speakers that go underneath. So there's no way I was going to be able to get that to go on a table and be flush, because the left side of it's going to be kicked out where those speaker grills go. And I'm not going to be able to cut it off, because it's got, you know, electronics underneath it and speakers and everything else. So I decided to see if I could start taking the screen out of my HDTV last night. And I believe I have voided the warranty on that. I may have voided the warranty. But I got it out, and it's awesome. It's just like you would see on a YouTube video. So now my screen's ready to slide into my frame once I build it. And I'm looking forward to it. The only thing I need is the metal legs for a pinball machine. And my buddy, Mass Commentator, says he might have a spare set of legs, because he has real tables, so he has spare parts. So I'm ready to start going down there. Now the only problem is I don't have a table saw, and I don't even really have a jigsaw. So it's probably gonna be a circular saw, and I'm do the best I can. But I don't know how to do any of this stuff, and I've been doing it with doing a bar, so I'm ready to take it on. We also have a tree in our yard that has to be cut down, and that's going to cost, well, it was estimated to cost $5,000 to take it down, because it's a huge, giant, 100-and-some-year-old tree. But I got a guy that's going to do it for $3,000, and we don't have that. We have to take out a loan. And so there's going to be another loan. Welcome to being an adult. Wow. But it has come down, because if we get anything bad, anything worse than what we've had with rain, the thing is strangling itself, because this hill, this home is built on a giant, like, slate slab, huge giant rock slab, and so the roots don't have anywhere to go down, so they're coming up and strangling itself, so it's dying that way. It has tremendous water damage right in the main trunk. The I don't even know how wide the trunk is. It's huge, maybe about 3 or 4 people with their hands stretched out. And then each branch that comes off of the main trunk is another whole tree. And there's 3 or 4 of those. And the way that it hangs, if it splits in half, the one half is going to crush our neighbor's home across the alleyway. And that's the problem. I mean, I don't care if it would just fall in our yard, and, you know, then insurance could take over. I don't want it falling on the neighbor's home and endangering their lives, endangering their home. You know, that's just not good. So it has to come down. But he's going to do it for $3,000 if he could take it to this one knot, sort of right below where all the giant branches come off the trunk, and I'm going to try to do some chainsaw artwork in it. And then if I can't make that happen, then he's going to come. I had a long, long talk with him. He told me exactly how he's going to do it. I'm going to take the bucket here, and I'm going to do this, and I can't do a grinder on the stump anyway because I'd have to drive the truck over your hill, and there's no way to do that because of the fences and the this gate is up, and there is that, and so it'd be hard to cut it down to the very bottom of the stump anyway, and impossible to drag a grinder over to grind down the stump below the grass level. So I said, listen, my big problem is, okay, we leave the big giant, 6 foot thing here to try to make some artwork out of it. And number one, I can't afford an artist because that's going to cost more than him taking down a tree. And number two, I might not feel comfortable in doing it or run out of time. And then I got this eyesore. And I said, will you agree to come back? And then we'll try to negotiate something to take it down the rest of the way at a later date. So he did that, and so I'm good with that. So that's the house. Sloppy Joe's is going well. Still open for business, and by business I mean I go there and no one else can. It's also going to be made a part of Foursquare pretty soon, so this is going to be interesting because I'm going to have to give my tips about it. And my tip will be, it is a private bar that no one can come to, and it has very weird hours because it's a guy's bar that no one's allowed in his house. And also my studio, the Trapdoor Tower Studio, is also going to be a place on Foursquare. Once again, a private private studio that no one is invited to. But I will have these numbers or something that you plug in and tells you when I'm there. So that's what I like about it. Because people ask me to join this Foursquare. Mikey Whipwreck asked me to join Foursquare. I don't even know what it is. So I'm still trying to figure it out, but I wanted my two places in my house to be a part of it. So they're mailing me something that I'm going to have to put on the window, and I don't know what else. It's weird. I'm sure there's a whole mess of other things I wanted to talk about as well, but I just cannot recall them. One thing is I know Akaria S. was being interviewed or somehow something else with Robert M. Price. I downloaded it, but I haven't had a chance to listen yet. It is on the most current version, which to you listening is now might be, I don't know how many ago, of Point of Inquiry. But Robert M. Price and Akari S. are on. I think they're just chatting to one another. I think Bob is probably hosting the show, and then Akari is on the call-in, or they're just sitting chit-chatting. I'm not sure. But I've been working my way through Greatest Story Ever Sold. And, it's like I mentioned about her writings before. It is every other paragraph is a sourced quote, sourced work, as Massey stated here, blah blah blah, as this guy stated here, da da da, in their works, and as they stated in their works, and it's all a bunch of sourced work, which is fantastic, but it's also very difficult to read. And The biggest problem with a lot of her work is that you can't Google it. Like, she made, because you have to actually go to a library or read, notes or blogs or, but mostly books, and just stuff that's so, I don't want to say wild, but so unknown that, like I said, you can't Google it. It's not on the internet yet. And there are things like this. Like, I still asked an unanswered question about video games way, way back when, on one of the first episodes of the rebooted We Talk Games, that no one's ever been able to answer yet. I gave a string of, I think, letters and numbers, and you can't Google it, so no one's ever answered it. And same thing with her stuff. So you really have, if you want to research, because some of these things are like, what do you mean? I don't know how to talk about her work yet. I'd love to have her on the show, but I don't know how to talk about it yet because I can't verify a lot of the things, a lot of the conclusions that she reaches, but they make a lot of them make a lot of sense if I could prove that they were true. And certainly the correlation of many of the Bible passages, Old and New Testament, certainly line up with it being inspired allegorically, allegorical to astrotheology, as she mentions. So that definitely lines up. There's one very interesting thing about Peter. Oh, hi, Levy. Chiz just sat down and scared the crap out of me. Scared the Peter out of me. Simon Bar-Jona, or perhaps Simon Cephas. But she mentions that the name Peter is, well, of course, Peter is associated with a cock crowing. Now, did the cock crow once? Oh, there goes Chizzy. She's being completely inconspicuous by making my guitars fall together. Thanks, Chiz. Yeah, thank you. Lovely. Great. You know, did his cock crow once, or did his cock crow twice before before the day was out and he betrayed Jesus thricely, denounced Jesus thricely? But see, now that's another problem, is what does it, does cock crowing mean something else? Are we talking you know, more of the Hebrew divide, since a cock crows twice in a day? Does that mean we're talking about the second time of the day, or are we trying to do some type of apologetic? You can actually make sense of one Matthew saying, Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you that this very night, before a cock crows, you shall deny me three times." In Luke, he says, "And he said, I say to you, Peter, the cock will not crow today until you have denied me three times." And then John says, Jesus answered, "Will you lay down your life for me? Truly I say to you, a cock shall not crow until you deny me three times." And then Mark says, "Truly I say to you that you yourself, this very night, before a cock crows twice, shall three times deny me." Now, of course, apologists will say that you can say that because the others don't say if the cock already crowed once, and you know, you can make all types of excuses. But Akari S. draws on the whole cock symbol, the penis, that the cock and the penis and the name Peter, you also call your penis a Peter, you also call your penis a cock, you also call your penis a Roman holiday. No, you don't do that. But, I mean, there's a lot of calls. Williker, your Willie. There's a lot of other names that you call it as well. But she's saying that Peter was the cock, the rooster god, the ancient drawings, or reliefs, rather, of a person with a penis rooster head. Like, his head is a rooster, but it has a penis face, and it's a person, and this is a more ancient god. And of course, it all actually goes back to I don't know, it's all a giant it's all this thing. That's what I mean, it's hard to decipher what how I could find out about this stuff. So it's quite confusing to me, and very hard to, impossible to Google this penis-headed rooster cock man. You can imagine what comes up in Google when you try to find this relief that she mentions in her book. So I'm still trying to sort all that out, but what it did remind me of is that the Gospel of Peter, of course, is a non-canonical book. It was voted out by the councils. They didn't want it to be a part of the Bible. Although it does go into the... Now, the Gospel of Peter is only in parts. We don't have the full Gospel, but we do have parts of it. And the parts that we have describe the Passion story and the crucifixion and, of course, the resurrection quite differently than the canonical versions of the Bible. And, you know, the canonical versions of the resurrection are completely different than one, irreconcilable with the orders and the descriptions of what happened here. Some of them, of course, I think the earliest one, which is Mark, just it's amazing. It shows what a piece of fiction this is, in that it ends by saying that the two women went to anoint and do their spices and stuff on Jesus. When it got there, the stone was moved away and the tomb was empty, and they were so scared that they didn't tell anyone. It's just like saying that the Pentateuch was written by Moses, and the Pentateuch ends by Moses writing, and then Moses died. if they didn't tell anyone, then to this day we wouldn't know the thing was empty, because they never told anybody. It's obviously fictive. It's obviously a story, you know, whether it's allegorical or whether it doesn't matter. It's a story. And the nice thing about reading this Acharias is that many of the sources that she quotes reinforce. Now, I didn't read this looking for any of my takes on the Bible to be reinforced. I read this because I want to see what she has to say about things that I might agree with. I definitely believe it's the greatest story ever sold. But, you know, I had no idea what it was going to say in there. And what it did say was that many of the people that she's quoting here, many of the scholars that she's quoting here, realize that the entire narrative reads as just that, a narrative, a story. The players in it, the whole using you know, Peter as a literary device, whether he has a penis head or not, he has to deny. I say to you that you will deny me these three times. And what do you know? He's talking to some people and he denies them three times, and then cock-a-doodle-doo. Well, if that doesn't sound like a story instead of something else, I don't know what does. It's also pointed out that the whole of the New Testament is, as far as the Jesus story goes, takes place over a 3-week period, perfect for a play. I always said that it sounded like a Shakespearean play, although you know, far before Shakespeare. But it sounded like a Greek play. You know what I mean? I don't know if it was a tragedy or a comedy, but I think a little of both. Well, wait, a comedy is something that's tragic, and a tragedy has comedy in it, right? I'm not sure. Theater geeks or whatever? Yeah, I wasn't one of those. I did bang a few people that were theater geeks. That's not even crude. But, you know, so the whole thing could have been done in a 3-act play, and the way that the whole trial thing, it's very rushed. It's very rushed. It's impossibility, the timeline. The fact that we know nothing, excuse me, you have the birth, and then we go right to 40, you know. Okay, he was 12 and he told some people off. 40, here we go. The whole layout of this, the non-descriptiveness of Jesus. No one says what he looks like ever. It's very, very interesting that all lines up with things that I noticed, my conclusions I came to myself before I even started really looking into it. It's what turned me off about the New Testament altogether. The Old Testament was much more lively, much more, had a lot more puzzles in it. Had a lot more, just about everything, except for the fact that the new. I swear, a piece that I was keeping for Robert M. Price, and I think I'll keep that. Never mind. But reading from a piece of Peter's Gospel, the ninth verse of something in the Gospel of Peter, and in the night in which the Lord's day was drawing on, as the soldiers kept guard two by two and watch. This was after he was crucified. And a neat thing about this is Pilate is exonerated in Peter's version of the gospel. They drew near. Let's see here. Yeah, let me back up a little bit. It is Herod that is the one that is held responsible for putting Peter to death, not Pilate. They delivered him to the people, blah, blah, blah. And they brought two male factors, and they crucified the Lord between them. But he held his peace as though having no pain. So this one, Jesus doesn't say anything. And when he was raised the cross, they wrote the title, the King of Israel. And having set his garments before him, they parted them among them, and they cast lots for them. Now, that this is all, as far as the casting of lots and things like this, this is all Midrash, which I spoke about with Bob Price before. They had to do this because this was in the what we now term the Old Testament. When the malefactors reproached him, saying, "We, for the evils we have done, have suffered thus, but this man who hath become the Savior of men, what wrath hath he done to you?" And they, being angered at him, commanded that his legs should not be broken, and that he must die in torment. The whole non-breaking of the legs, like I had brought up to, make Bob known to this. I just brought it up. And everything here happened at night. They said they had to bring their lanterns and give him to drink gall with vinegar. That's all this stuff. And many went with lamps, supposing that it was night, and fell down. And the Lord cried out, saying, "My power, my," instead of my God, why have you forsaken me? He says, "My power, my power, thou hast forsaken me, thou hast left me." And when he had said it, he was taken up. And in that hour, the veil of the temple of Jerusalem was rent in twain. So the temple in Jerusalem earthquaked apart, fell asunder, crumbled. And he was taken up at that time, according to this gospel. And then they drew out the nails from the hands of the Lord and laid him upon the earth. And the whole earth quaked. So there was an earthquake that, of course, was not reported by anyone. But it was also recorded in other canonical texts. And a great fear arose, and then the sun shone. And it was the fourth in the ninth hour. And the Jews rejoiced and gave his body to Joseph that he might bury it, since he had seen what good things he had done. And he took the Lord and washed him and rolled him in linen cloth and brought him into his own tomb, which he called the Garden of Joseph. So this is all probably related to, in some ways, perhaps, I don't know if I could figure it out, to some type of astrotheology, the setting of the sun, the movement from the Aquarius and all this other business I'm still trying to wrap my head around. We fasted on a Saturday morning, weeping night and day until the Sabbath. So a lot of other things happen. Pilate set centurions, guards. They set up camp. They're guarding the tomb night and day. So here we are at this number 9. And in the night in which the Lord's day was drawing on, so we're going through Saturday night. No, Saturday day it has to be. Lord's Day. Oh, Lord's Day would be... that might be Sunday, because that's what the Lord's Day is named after, the sun, which could be translated to Lord because Adonai, and then El, and all this other business comes. El, Ana, El. See what I mean? You're dealing with so many different languages here. So that probably means Sunday. Okay, so not the Sabbath, which is Saturday. Friday night into Saturday day, so it's confusing. Lord's Day was drawing on as the soldiers, and then, of course, calling God the Lord, calling Jesus the Lord. That doesn't make anything easier. Soldiers kept guard two by two and watch. There was a great voice in heaven, and they saw the heavens opened, and two men descend from thence with great light and approach the tomb. And that stone which was put at the door rolled on itself and made way in part, and the tomb was opened. So two men come down, the stone rolls away by itself, the guards are all watching this, and the tomb was open, and both the young men entered in. Now we go into 10. When therefore those soldiers saw it, they awakened the centurion and the elders, for they too were hard by keeping guard. And as they declared what things they had seen, again they see three men come forth from the tomb, and two of them supporting one. So two men carrying another man. And a cross following them. Yes, the cross was walking behind the two men carrying the other man. And of the two, the head reached unto the heaven. So the two men's head reached to the heaven. But the head of him that was led by them overpassed the heavens. So the guy that was on top of them or in front of them, his head was above the heavens. And then whatever that means. And then he heard, was he giant? Maybe. I think he was giant. I think they were giants. I'm not sure. That probably means something completely different. But see, this all sounds very astronomical. And as they heard a voice from the heavens saying,
"Thou hast preached to them that sleep."
And a response was heard from the cross. Yay! I'm a cross. I'm walking around and I say yes. When your bank says no, this cross says yes. So Peter had, in his gospel, has a walking, talking cross. So... Another thing I was reminded of was by the reading some of these books was, so I don't know, was Peter a cock-headed ding-dong? I don't know. But he definitely wrote some freaky crap. But I was also reminded of a great passage from the Old Testament. And, you know, this is going back to Numbers. Numbers 21. We always like to hear about the Moses. Numbers 21:4. They traveled from Mount Hor along the route of the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. Now, we're in Numbers. So, you know, Moses is leading his chosen people. around to find a place where they could settle. They're out of Egypt, and now they're walking around looking for some place to pitch their tents, so to speak. There's also that thing about petered out. You know, you're petered out, meaning maybe your pecker is growing soft. So, you know, it's all just very odd. It's all very odd. Anyway, and interesting, actually, and I need to look more into it before I can speak on it. So Numbers 21:4, they traveled from Mount Hor and they go out of there, but the people grew impatient on the way. Of course they do. They're always complaining, these people that were saved from slavery. They're always like, I don't want to eat this anymore. I want to worship a golden calf. I saw all these signs of God, but I don't believe. Morons. If this is an allegorical or something, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything more goofy than these goofs that are like, see God, see his the physical changes he makes, sea turn red, parting the sea, covering up troops, and yet they still don't believe. What dipshits these people are. Anyway, they traveled from Mount Hor. I'm still marking this as not being offensive, this episode. They grew impatient along the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food. Numbers 21:6, the only way that God can respond, of course. Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. Some say that they were flying venomous snakes, by the way. The Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, we sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord take the snakes away from us. So Moses prayed for the people. But then, 21:8, reading along, the Lord said to Moses,
make a snake and put it on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live.
So Moses made a bronze snake and put it on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by the snakes that God sent among the people, they looked at the bronze snake and then they lived. Did you know that? Yeah. This snake staff, we later learn, is called the Nehushtan, I think that's what it is. Nehushtan. This was an actual artifact that probably existed. It's in a lot of, reliefs from Jesus, the 16th century and stuff like that. That's really no proof of it, but it may have existed. The reason that it might have existed, or at least was known by later writers of the Torah and the, or what we call the Old Testament, is because when King Hezekiah reigned in approximately 715 to 687 BCE, it is documented according to 2 Kings 18:4 if you read from 2 Kings 18:1, in the year of Hosea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abiah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places. So the places where you would be able to worship God only in, he did that. He smashed the sacred stones and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had begun burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan. So King Hezekiah got all bent out of shape because of the serpent stick that if first of all God first of all, the people complain that their food sucks. And then, of course, God does the only thing he can do. Instead of, like, sending down a short order cook or something, he, of course, sends flying serpents down to bite them, bee people. And then because the people say, oh, whoops, we made a mistake, oops. Instead of God getting rid of the snakes, like, you know, with his magic wand, he tells Moses to make a magic wand with a gold snake on it, and then if people look at that snake, then their pain will be taken away from the bites that they get. Which sounds incredibly like exactly the thing an almighty deity would do that created you and me and knows everything and is all kind, is all good, and all knowing, and all benevolent, omnibenevolent, all that business. But then again, you might just say, that's the Old Testament. They were goofs. I believe in the Jesus and a New Testament. Ha ha! Wouldn't be something if someone used that good old golden stick of Moses's in the New Testament talking about Jesus. John 3:14. So close. John 3:14. Very close to a very famous line. And it goes, and as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So, the serpent stick in the wilderness, in the desert, is very integral and real to the author, John, posing as John. The author John, as in John 3:14. That is something that really happened. Time and time again, we get quotes of Balaam's ass talking, you know what I mean? In the New Testament, these things, and that was coming right out of they put that right in the mouth of Jesus, saying that. So we have to believe in a talking donkey. We have to believe in a golden stick that when you looked at it, you would be cured of flying serpent bites that God sent to bite people. Is it any wonder that the deists, going back to our founding fathers, I mean, going back to the Gnostics who took a different take on most, well, Gnostics may have been responsible for the Book of Peter, but, the Gospel of Peter. Is it any wonder that the theists wanted no part of this Bible? All you need do is read. I wanted to talk more about Balaam. I wanted to talk about more about the tragic fertility of Canaan. But I'm going to wrap it up right now. I just want to leave you with one thing, and it's going to be allegorical, or rather, analogy. It will be an analogy. Remember our old friend Maverick, going blast from the past. You might not know if you're new to the show, but if you do. No, Maverick. Evidently, Maverick is still listening to this show, I guess, only. I have no idea in the wide, wide world of sports why Maverick is still listening to any of my programs anymore. Well, like I said, probably just this one. But I can understand of no reason, I can think of no reason why he would still want to be in any way listen to this program, since I disagree with evidently with everything that he believes I am at odds with. So the fact that he listens to what I am saying is just, I don't know, is he trying to torture himself? And Maverick's a guy that, you know, I really like. I gave him a voice on Smart Wrestling Fan when other people were saying, no, turn it off, turn him off, cut his mic. I gave him a voice. I gave him a place to speak. He called in Magic Milkshake once. I gave him a voice, you know, I gave him a place to speak there. And would respond to many of his things. And, I had, I since Of course, I block him from everything, so I don't know if he's, you know, sending me things. I don't. He's blocked from my email. He's blocked from my Facebook. He's blocked from other, because there's just some things that I didn't feel like looking at anymore, addressing anymore. I was tired of it. It was old to me. But I still, you know, nothing wrong with the fella. He's a good fella. But evidently, there's still channels to Chiz, and Chiz had made mention about when I talked about how I thought it was not truly American for people to have been dancing out in the street, the type of reaction that we had when Osama bin Laden was killed. It just seemed like it was not appropriate. It seemed like we are complaining about people that, about things that people don't like, and then when the shoe's on the other foot, we do the same exact things, and it was disrespectful to the 50,000 kids that have lost their lives in this war. It's not like, okay, you know, we took out a despot, and, you know, it was a surgical mission like it was. But the problem is that it was prefaced by this trillions of dollar war that saw the bloodshed of a 10-year war now, based under false pretenses, murdering our youth, you know, and endangering their lives, which could have been a surgical strike from the beginning. Might not have went well, but if, listen, you throw a couple billions, what is it, like 30-some billion dollars a month, $32 billion a month or something, we're still spending on the war. I don't have my figures correct there, but that's what I think it is. You throw $32 billion at a precision strike, guess what? You might hit the mark somewhere. You put a $32 billion bounty on someone's head, I don't give a crap if you're turning your own mother. I mean, listen, someone's going to narc for $32 billion. That's 1 month. No casualties. Except maybe someone trying to get the $32 billion. But I mean, really, that it's been a senseless thing. So you can't just say, okay, dancing in the streets okay when you kill a despot. But I'm going to give you an analogy, and then I'm going to leave. I mentioned about the Jenny McCarthy thing. You know, and Goofy. You know, it's not good to make fun of people and you know, call people's names and be, especially comedians, you shouldn't be mean to them. You know, like, you shouldn't say rude things about that asshole Jim Carrey. You know what I mean? He's just trying to do his thing and endanger the lives of the youth of America and abroad. With his goofy wife, who now says that her son was cured of autism because he's an emerald child or something like that. Can't remember what the next evolution of human life. And how impassioned she was when she was saying how she was protecting our children. Well, listen, I'm not going to go into that. But If you knew me back then, and on Smart Wrestling Fan, I got drug into this because the WWE was promoting Jenny McCarthy, and her group that she was standing behind. And listen, and see, this concerns our kids. So I wasn't. Speaking out about Jenny McCarthy because I didn't want to protect the youth of America. I do. I care passionately. I care desperately. And that's why I was speaking out against her, because she was basing, she was saying a lot of false testimony based on anecdotal information and confusing causation with relation. A casual relations with a time period where people are usually diagnosed with autism, and it is recognized, and it is around the time that you start walking, with a time when you would receive certain immunization shots. So although it was casually related by a time period, there was zero evidence for causation except for one doctor that was doing a small 12-group study, which featured no double blinds, no anything. It showed casual relationships. And these were the types of things I was trying to bring out, and said it was horrible for the WWE to be promoting this pseudoscience as it was at the time. And I probably didn't even speak that strongly in those strong tones at the time. But I stood firmly by what I had to say. And there were all this type of kickbacks on it because it was a pro wrestling show. Well, I'm sorry. Pro wrestling brought Jenny McCarthy and her baseless accusations into the mix here. And I brought rationality to it. So, but that doesn't mean that I did not want, you know, to bring autism awareness. Autism awareness is what they were bringing this out under the guise of. And see, that's the problem. I am all for autism awareness. I'm all for helping, just like I was on last episode when I talked about child psychiatry and child medication and things like this. I pointed you to places like Special that gave sound advice for parents, symptoms to look for, what to be concerned about, what not to be concerned about, and also to the National Mental Health website. So, you know, I had links in there. I mentioned these. I always preface anything I talk about to dealing with mental health that if you feel like helping yourself, hurting yourself or others, dial 911 or the national equivalent to that, depending on where you live. And present my cases as anecdotal, because that's all I can speak on, but point you hopefully to places where you could look, where the material is sourced, where there are double blind studies, where there are triple blind studies, where there is some actual science behind the things that I'm trying to communicate to you. Now, how does this relate to what I said about killing Osama bin Laden? It relates in this way. When that doctor was found to be a complete fraud, having greed motivate wanting to publish his findings, his publication in the one serious journal was rescinded when they found out about the methodologies and the things behind this. But when he was exposed as a complete fraud with money in stocks invested in this other type of thing that would challenge the vaccinations he was speaking out against. What if I would have went, ha 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 ha, you goofs? I did not feel vindicated. I felt a type of vindication. I felt like finally, you know, this, what I was talking about, is true. But for me to laugh and to carry on and go shoot a gun and go woo-hoo and click my heels together would be completely inappropriate, because that doesn't change the existence of autism. I am concerned with the autistic children. I am concerned with autistic adults and various forms of autism and various levels and Asmunch syndrome, which I spoke about before. You know, Asperger's syndrome, bad enough you have that, then they have to call it Asperger. You know, that's a person's name. They can't help that, but it's just, wow. You know what I mean? That I can laugh at, but I'm not going to laugh at people. I'm not laughing at, people that have to, work with this, live with this. I can take it seriously. I'm not going to feel it's not I feel sorry for people. I truly understand it, you know what I mean? But I'm not going to go, yahoo, whoopee, I was right, haha, you were wrong. And that to me is the type of respect I would expect out of myself, and just the type of respect I expected out of other Americans. That's all. So, my friends, hopefully I've left you with some good things. Remember to be happy if you so want to be, and it's okay for you to be happy. Now, don't sweat that. Happy if you want to, man. Happy if you want to. thank you, everybody, for listening. Truly, I can't say that enough. Thank you so very much for being there through my life. If you like any of my music, if you like any of my art on DeviantArt, there's all links on wigglesworld.com. Share out wigglesworld.com. Say, hey, come take a look at some of this stuff. It's kind of neat, I hope. I also put a thing on my Facebook that I'm looking for some crayon works that I did when I was younger. Around 1987, they were stolen. I lent them out to an art teacher that had come into my house. I showed her a lot of my crayon works. She said, oh my gosh, this is so great. I want to share it with my students. And about, you know, over the course of the next year, I said, can you bring back my pieces yet that you borrowed? And she always kept stalling, and she finally had to admit that they were stolen. So I'm trying to find them. Again, the main piece I'm looking for is that Smash Kronatovich piece, which he's an undead alien with floating neck vertebrae and real wild, not new wave, goth type of hair at the time, beyond the Cure, you know what I mean? So I'm really looking for that piece. I'd love to have that back in my possession to scan and then possibly to sell. I'm sure that perhaps many of these pieces were given to other people as if they were done by that person. Doesn't matter. I don't care who you are. I don't care why you got it, where you got it. I don't care if you were the one that stole it. No, just like them back now, please, and I'll gladly make you a print of them somehow. But I guess I sell things on DeviantArt, I don't even know, and or any donations that you feel like making towards me, I could really use the money. Yes, I'm spending money, but yes, I'm still doing things. I still only work part-time and think that the other bit of my income is going to come from my art, and it's not. So, you know, anything you could spare, I appreciate it. And I work very hard. I work very diligently. And if you think anything's worth anything, feel free, and if not, that's cool. And I know, because I know it's very hard times. And never stop listening, or, you know, if you enjoy anything I do, never stop because you feel like you owe me anything. Because that, because just because you want to listen is more than payment enough. Believe me. Thank you, everybody. What am I going to leave you with? I have no idea. I'm going to have to come back, and whatever it is, I'm going to edit it into the show. It'll probably be one of my songs. You know what? I want to end with, I think, Michael Tedesco, the song. I think I ended with that not too long ago. But I never hear from Michael that he likes or doesn't like my inorganic Mumbians album. I know that he used to always make quips to Mr. Mark, oh, you're really going to get laid that way, when he used to play ambient style music and weird music. And I wonder if Michael feels that way about that album. But I, like I said, I wrote that Inorganic Mumbians album because I didn't like that ambient style music either. I wrote this so that I could like it because I can see potential in it. The problem with ambient music is that it drones on and on and on and on and on the same thing. When I got tired of a movement in there, when I got tired of a piece, I moved on to another movement, another direction. I switched it up a bit. There's some songs that have choruses, for cripe's sake, in an ambient piece. Not singing, but they're in there. You know what I mean? I tried to make it interesting for me to want to listen to. And there's definitely very different types of things that probably wouldn't be considered ambient music. It's very experimental, let's call it that. So I'll probably end with something off of there, and hope to do more music soon, my friends, and hope to do more artwork and bring to you what I can. Oh, great We Talk Games. Last We Talk Games number 771. If you haven't listened to it, please do. There's a great interview with Roger Sharp. It was one of my favorite interviews that I've done. I've done a lot of favorites. But it was great to have him back on again. And boy, does he praise our show. Holy cripes. And I did that piece of artwork I would mention that was probably the best thing I've ever done. I finally used the pen tool in Photoshop. I've used it before, but I never knew what I was supposed to be doing with it. Now I stroke my pieces, and they look great. It's in the art style of this fella Christian March. but it features Stinky TT and Roger Sharp, and you can see a picture of it in my album artwork on my Facebook or something. Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much. You know what? Maybe I'm going to make that my album art. The artwork for episode 71 of We Talk Games, I'm making the album art for this episode of A Wiggly World. But please listen to it. It's a season finale. It's a great episode, top to bottom. We talk about so many different things, so many good things, and it ends with a cliffhanger, as any season finale will. So who knows? Maybe I'm not even alive anymore. Maybe I'm a ghost talking to you. We don't even know. No one will know until the fall season rolls around again. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I appreciate it more than you can know. I'm Wiggly, A Wiggly World.
Yeah.